This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind chamber where in 28 minutes, you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts. This week, what is the science and practice of the local lockdown? The Treasury thinks it's national party time. This week it tweeted out a jolly reminder, complete with sound effects, that the pubs in England are reopening this weekend. Grab a drink, raise a glass, it read. And at exactly the same time, the city of Leicester was locking down again. The tweet's gone now, but Leicester's lockdown is still happening and may be the first of many. So today, I want to know what such lockdowns will look like, who will decide when they happen, and how are people likely to react? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. The story begins in Leicester, and so shall we. Amy Orton is a reporter for the Leicester Mercury.
So the schools are closed for all but key worker children and the vulnerable pupils. All non-essential retail is closed, so in the city centre and some of the retail parks on the edge of the city. And from the weekend, people in Leicester and the affected areas won't be able to pop for a pint at the pub or have their hair cut either. So quite different to the rest of the country by Saturday, I think.
People around you, as they talk about this, how are they feeling about it?
To begin with, people were confused about what the messages were and what they are allowed and what they aren't allowed to do. I think there's still some confusion around that now. So things that maybe people were planning to do at the weekend, meeting up with friends, family, seeing people that they've not seen for a long time that they were looking forward to doing. We now have a situation where there's some people inside the red line and some people outside the red line. And as we understand it, they're not going to be able to mix with each other apart from outside in the park, 2 metres away in groups of six or less. I think a lot of people were fairly angry to begin with. I think they felt like Leicester was being a bit picked on. People are fed up. I think they're already tiring of lockdown and the rules, and they're struggling to stick to them as it is. One question that we keep being asked is, what difference will it make for us to stay in lockdown for another 2 weeks? Because these cases have appeared at a time when we were already locked down. The survey that we had on our website suggested that people who were completing the survey were saying that they only thought 7% of people will stick to the rules now that we're in the extended lockdown.
I'm looking at a report from the Rapid Investigation Team, RIT, and it's from Public Health England, called Preliminary Investigation into COVID-19 Exceedances in Leicester, June 2020. And it's really fascinating because right in the middle, there's one ward that's had just about no cases. And then there's a whole series of wards where there's a big cluster. And on the outside, there's a whole series of places where it's been very low. What's your understanding?
I think the focus seems to be in the north and the east of the city. I think it's the North Evington ward that had 161 cases, I think it was, which was substantially higher than any of the other wards in the area. There's some investigation going into that now by Public Health and by the Department of Health and Social Care. And what we understand at this stage is that there is no one setting that this has come from. So the report does highlight a few places where there have been outbreaks or clusters, as they call them, and there's a couple that have been profiled as a threat even. They were settings like care homes, schools and workplaces. There's talk about garment factories, which are based in that area of the city. There's talk about some food production as well that's in some of the northern areas of the city. The overriding thing is that at the moment, it appears that public health can't attribute this to one setting. I think it appears that it's within the community and it's moving around the community.
What have you heard about how the Leicester lockdown will be enforced? I mean, what are the police going to do?
At this stage, I think the police and the authorities are relying on goodwill. They're relying on people following the rules and sticking to the rules, as we did when the whole country went into full lockdown towards the end of March. There's been no talk yet of things like roadblocks, you know, some of the more dramatic things that we've seen elsewhere in other countries. Our local chief constable has encouraged people not to leave the lockdown area to go a few miles down the road for a pint in an area that isn't locked down. We've had the police chief in Nottingham warning people from Leicester to stay away. I think they've even gone as far to say today that they'll be checking ID. And if your postcode is one that's within the lockdown area, you'll be turned around and sent home. It feels like a warning. It is a really strict form of lockdown in comparison to what everyone else will be doing from Saturday.
Amy Orton. That's what's already happening in Leicester. But what's the science that underpins local lockdowns? Dr. Natalie McDermott is an epidemiologist at Imperial College London.
The goal of any lockdown is to try and reduce the transmission of an infectious disease, or in this case, COVID-19, within a population. So it's something that you would implement when you've got rapidly increasing numbers of cases in a region and you want to try and reduce that. And you do so by trying to limit people interacting with one another. But the goal is to try and interrupt transmission amongst the population.
In the case of local lockdown, what data is being used to make the decision about whether one might be necessary?
The data being used is looking at trends in the number of new cases in different regions of the UK. So it will either look at that as just a raw figure of the number of new cases each week or each day, depending on how rapidly they might be increasing. But it can also look at the number of new cases per 100,000 people in a population. And you might also look at rates of positive tests among the number of tests being done. So that helps you to understand when you're doing lots of tests, if what you're seeing is actually just related to you doing more testing than you were before, or whether the actual proportion of positive tests amongst that group of tests is increasing.
Are we essentially talking about cases that present at hospitals, cases that present at doctor's surgeries? How is that arrived at?
So actually, really, you want to be looking at all cases wherever possible. Now, the figures that are being reported by Public Health England at the moment are divided into two categories. One is Pillar 1 and one is Pillar 2. Pillar 1 is people being tested in a hospital setting, and Pillar 2 is more people being tested in the community. And that's where we've started to see a difference in the number of positive cases in Leicester. But it seems that it was really only Pillar 1 data that was initially being reported to the local areas and to the local public health authorities in different regions of the UK, and that the Pillar 2 data was not necessarily being reported as quickly to them for them to interpret.
Natalie, if you do get what appears to be a local outbreak, but you have a fairly good idea where it may have originated and what might have caused it, is it possible to try and contain it without going to a local lockdown?
Yes. So if you can pinpoint one specific factor that might have been involved, such as some kind of event or gathering of people, if it's possible to trace all of those individuals very promptly afterwards and ask them all to self-isolate and ask all of their contacts to self-isolate, then it is possible to avoid a local lockdown. If you were to see an outbreak start in one school in particular, it would be possible to say to that school, right, this school is closing for a period of time. Everyone, all the staff, all the children and all their families and close contacts must self-isolate at home, and then monitor the situation and see if that addresses the increased number of cases. The problem is at the moment that it's very difficult to explain the reason behind the local outbreak in Leicester. It seems that the new increase in cases is related to increased numbers in young adults and the adult working population rather than in older adults, which is what we saw at the beginning of the epidemic throughout the UK. But the reason behind that is somewhat unclear at the moment.
Looking at what has happened in Leicester, would you say that we're going to see the same thing happen elsewhere in the country? And I know this is an unfair question, but if we are, where do you think it may happen first?
I think there's some concern of rising cases at the moment in Doncaster and Bolton. Having said that, the numbers are still quite small, so it's possible that this could just be a slight variation from 1 week to the next in what we're seeing. But it's certainly something that would need to be monitored to make sure it's not getting worse or that it is actually plateauing and then coming down.
Now, if you take a very large city, and I'm thinking a place the size of London or maybe Birmingham or Glasgow, if you got an outbreak in part of that city, would you be able just to contain the lockdown to an area of a city?
That would depend on whether the outbreak is in a very specific location in that city where it's possible to identify and trace everyone. But the likelihood is that it would apply to an entire city because it's very difficult within a highly populated urban area to trace everyone who might have had contact and to identify things as being in one specific area. It's also important that we think about the consequences of locking down one particular region of a city, which may have a higher level of ethnic minorities within it and might be perceived as oppression of a particular ethnic minority group, in which case it might be more appropriate to ensure keeping the peace and order that actually the lockdown covers a slightly wider area that encompasses multiple communities and multiple ethnic groups and different religious groups as well.
Dr. Natalie McDermott. The United Kingdom is not the first country in which a local lockdown has been imposed in response to the pandemic. The city of Wuhan in China was the earliest, followed by regions of Italy. More recently, at least 16 US states have paused or rolled back reopenings. Parts of the city of Melbourne in Australia are back in lockdown. And closer to home, in Germany, the authorities are taking action to deal with regional outbreaks. So we asked the BBC's Damian McGuinness in Berlin to explain what's happening there.
Germany is often held up as a role model for tackling the pandemic, and indeed overall infection and death rates remain relatively low. But when it comes to individual outbreaks, mistakes have been made here too. Under its federal system, it is regional governments who decide many of the details of how to deal with local flare-ups. In the town of Göttingen in Lower Saxony, police were attacked with fireworks, bottles and metal bars after an apartment block was suddenly surrounded by wire fences. Local residents, many poorer families from ethnic minorities, said they didn't have enough to eat. And in North Rhine-Westphalia, where more than 1,500 workers at an abattoir were infected, officials are accused of acting too late. But so far, infection rates show that local outbreaks have been contained. And amid ferocious debate, Germany's political leaders are slowly inching towards a consensus. Regions now go into local lockdown when, over 7 days, there are more than 50 new infections per 100,000 of population. That was the case in the district of Gütersloh after the abattoir outbreak. That now means that for 250,000 people there, schools, bars and non-essential shops have closed down again. And almost 7,000 employees from the meat processing plant have been put into quarantine, with their homes sometimes sealed off behind metal fences. But as Germans head for the coast for summer holidays, how do you stop people from an infected region travelling to the rest of the country? A new regulation means that before being able to book into a hotel, people from a region with an outbreak have to show proof of a recent negative COVID-19 test. But still, you can't conduct border checks around a local authority. So how do you stop people spending their daytime in lockdown and their evenings going to the pub?
Wir wissen, dass im Kreis Gütersloh die Infektionszahlen nicht gestiegen sind.
Leaders in the region where the abattoir outbreak happened are now suggesting even more localized lockdowns. We need to use a scalpel, not the sabre, said the state premier, Armin Laschet, this week. In other words, shutting down neighbourhoods or areas of just a few square miles, and presumably giving relevant support to the people affected. In Berlin, individual apartment buildings or city blocks have been sealed off to contain outbreaks. Instead of using wire fences and police batons, though, officials have tried to focus on communication and cooperation. Rather than brute force, social workers, doctors and volunteers have gone in with supplies and, crucially, proper explanations to residents about what's going on. Elsewhere, individual nursing homes or businesses have been isolated. To do this, local government departments need to be properly funded and well organised. And of course, whether it's the lockdown of an entire local authority or a single house or street put into quarantine, without proper testing, it's not even possible to know where the outbreaks are in the first place and whether they're being successfully contained.
Damien McGuinness in Berlin. Back to the UK. The Prime Minister has talked about a whack-a-mole strategy for dealing with local flare-ups in England. The virus pops up somewhere and you lock down and see it off. And the same approach could also be taken by devolved administrations in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. So in this second half of the programme, I want to know who decides when and where there's a local mole that needs whacking and what happens when they do. Alex Thomas is a civil servant turned programme director for the Institute for Government, and Greg Fell is the director of public health for the City of Sheffield. Alex Thomas, what do we know about how decisions on when and where to introduce local lockdowns will be made?
Well, probably not quite enough at the moment, but we do have quite a good sense, particularly following Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary's statement earlier in the week about the structure through which those decisions will be taken. So there's a bit of an alphabet soup of organisations, but the two really important ones are Public Health England, PHE, and the Joint Biosecurity Centre that this government set up. So they'll be looking on the ground, analysing data, looking for problems, spikes in the disease. They will also be working with the local authority. And then that feeds into what is a classic government crisis response structure, where issues are escalated up from a local level at Bronze Command, then through to the Chief Medical Officer at Silver Command, and then through to ministers and the Health Secretary and the Prime Minister at Gold Command, who take the final decisions about lockdown. The same process of escalation will apply in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, but the decision makers will be the health ministers and the first ministers in each of those nations.
So let me get this absolutely clear. At local level, you can't decide yourself to lock down locally. It's not like a US state where the US state can decide it without reference to the president.
If we're talking about a Leicester-style, what we've come to know as a full-fat local lockdown, really only the national government has the power to do that. And actually, we think they're going to need to take some extra powers in order to make sure it can happen. There are specific powers that local authorities have to shut down individual premises or to say that children shouldn't go to school. So it is possible for local authorities to take decisions off their own bat in those specific areas. But requiring people to stay at home, for example, would go to a national level.
Now, what are the triggers which escalate something up from bronze through silver to gold command, and therefore from purely local, as I understand it, up to national?
This is an area, again, where it would be good to see a bit more clarity from the government. Unlike, say, in France and Germany, as we heard earlier, the government hasn't set out a clear framework of triggers. But what they have said is that they're keeping a close eye on the reproduction rates that we've all come to be familiar with over the last few months, and the incidence of disease. And so when you get a spike that looks worrying, as has happened in Leicester and potentially in other areas of the country, they will do that. But that's a judgment on the ground at the moment. We haven't yet got to a position where the government said an automatic trigger will come in if X or Y happens.
Greg Fell, you're the director of public health for the City of Sheffield. So essentially, you are kind of bronze command, aren't you?
Yep.
It starts with you. So what's the plan when you see a spike in infections, and how will you judge when to act?
It kind of depends on the context. We've had a number of outbreaks within a workplace, and we've had a number of outbreaks within care homes. We've not yet
had an outbreak within a school. But for a workplace and a care home, we'll work out what we do and we don't know. We'll take a risk assessment and then you apply whatever interventions are needed to break the chain of transmission at the lowest level possible. Because nobody wants to lock down Sheffield or a part of Sheffield. But we have broken the chain of transmission, for instance, in the workplaces where we've had outbreaks. With regard to a defined setting or a defined context, we've got legal powers already. They work really well. They're very well exercised. And actually, we very rarely have to actually apply those legal powers in an enforcement way.
So if you have an outbreak in a workplace, firstly, how do you know it's in the workplace? Second, what do you then do and what can you demand that they do?
What happens practically is that person develops symptoms, person gets tested. They are contacted by NHS Test and Trace. And in that line of questioning, one of the questions is, where do you work? And if more than one person says the same company, that automatically triggers a referral mechanism to our Public Health England local centre. PHE local centre will then contact the business. They'll also contact me at the same time and we'll have an incident meeting, sit down and work out what we do and don't know, how many people are affected, when they became ill, who else is likely to be exposed, what the available interventions to us are, which, you know, nobody wants to get into the business of shutting a workplace for obvious reasons. It's not something we want to do, but it is the ultimate thing.
And what would happen if you understood that they weren't taking your advice?
I think in the context of an individual institution, be it a business in this context or a school or a care home, I think our powers within the Public Health Act of 1984 are sufficient that we can require the business or the institution cease operations. Our problem comes when we have to apply that to a whole sector, the whole of the non-essential retail sector. The Public Health Act 1984 doesn't apply there, but the Coronavirus Act, which was pushed through Parliament in February, March, does. But as we found out in Leicester, the powers, the legal powers are vested within the Secretary of State for Health.
Which gets back to that sort of patchwork of different legal interventions that you can apply. I think for me, though, this does illustrate that while it's really important that it's clear under what powers a local authority is acting or the national government is acting and that Parliament has a chance to scrutinise those and everybody knows what they are, in the end, in a crisis like this, the specific legal powers are far less important than the communications, messaging, persuasion, because we've seen Parliament can legislate incredibly quickly on this sort of stuff. There's not going to be any opposition in the midst of a crisis. So the really important thing is clear communications about why measures are needed and then being really clear on what those measures are.
Greg Felt, I'm wondering, are you in Sheffield currently getting the data that you need?
Nearly. So I get weekly data on who has tested positive down to postcode level. What we've all been promised, and I'm hoping I'll get this very soon, is daily or near daily, as close to real time as possible, data on all those who test as well as those who test positive. That enables me to do the surveillance in a really, really granular way and enables me to actually manage an outbreak and enables me to put together the hard data with the soft intelligence, because it's the soft intelligence is usually days ahead. Some kind of overlaying context onto that, which won't be known to somebody nationally, but would be really important to me.
I'm sorry, maybe I'm being dim a bit, or maybe it was because I, at a too early age, watched Jaws and the mayor trying to stop everybody leaving the beaches by saying there were no sharks. What happens if the local authority doesn't want to lock down, but the national government thinks it should?
The national government could require the local authority to lock down then. It would be a far from ideal situation, as Greg would tell us.
Now, let's just talk about the example of Australia, where there's a big local lockdown in Melbourne, and there are now potential fines for leaving your home without a good reason and a possible prison sentence for crossing into neighbouring Australian states. This is really kind of quite swinging. You might have fences going up to stop people leaving and so on. Can we envisage being able to take such severe action here or anywhere else?
So I think theoretically, of course, it is possible, because anywhere in the UK, the government could legislate to impose really, really severe lockdowns. In practice, if you think even in the depths of the crisis at the end of March and in April, the extent of the lockdown that was imposed was requiring people to stay in their homes, but not to that kind of authoritarian level that you describe. So I think it's unlikely that you would go further than in a local lockdown than we went in a national lockdown, with the proviso that you would potentially need particular rules to stop people moving around, because the sort of simplicity of the national lockdown is that everyone was doing exactly the same thing at the same time. You didn't get those border effects. So I think you could see what in which people were restricted from moving between areas of the country. I mean, the government, it was very striking to me to hear the phrase, the government advises against all but essential travel to Leicester. I mean, that really brought home the import of it.
Well, it seems a very good point to look at another aspect of this, because also on the line to the briefing room is Gillie Gibson-Miller, a health psychologist at the University of Sheffield and one of the lead researchers for the COVID-19 Psychological Research Consortium. What do you feel about what would motivate people to either comply or to resist compliance with the sorts of local lockdowns we've been discussing?
I've been working from a model called the COMBI model, which provides a framework for understanding the determinants of behaviour. So COM stands for capability, opportunity and motivation. The B is the behaviour. So, you know, it's really important that people, like, they know what it is that they require to do. So it's really important for those clear messages that have very specific behavioural aspects to them so that people know what they're doing. It's also important to know why they're doing it. So in terms of what Greg was saying, what are the infection rates locally and how can people individually, by behaving in ways to follow the guidelines, impact upon infection rates? So there's a clear rationale there. In terms of the opportunity, it's really important to create these social norms around these behaviours. It's very supportive to people if they see other people doing the same sorts of things. And that's a real driver for following guidelines. And in terms of motivational processes, again, it's really important for people to understand why they're doing it.
Gillie, one of the things that people have said made compliance significant in the early days of the national lockdown was this sense that we all did it together. And the other thing is that they also felt that there was a kind of limit to the length of time we would have to do it. Now, in a local lockdown, you wouldn't all be in it together, and you've already been through one big set of lockdowns, so you might have this thing called lockdown fatigue. How are these elements going to play with the determinants you've been talking about?
Yeah, we are asking people to perform very difficult behaviours. And we know from research that's been done so far in the COVID pandemic that actually isolation especially is very costly to health and well-being. And yes, as time goes on, psychological resources will be depleted. And it's important also to think about what competing aspects acting upon people's behaviour. So they want to see their families, you know, we're social beings. And these kind of drivers of behaviour might actually compromise people's ability to social distance and keep up the guidelines. The national lockdown was perhaps easier because everybody was doing it. There was no discrimination, no favourites. But I'm wondering if, you know, local lockdowns might actually be more effective because there's that local element. They're all working towards a common goal, like the lockdown in Sheffield or the lockdown in Bakewell, for example. We're doing it for the community. And that sense of community and the common goal, the fact that we're all in it together, actually might maintain and strengthen the motivation to want to follow the guidelines.
So your message would be, we're doing this for Leicester, we're doing this for Sheffield,
yes,
we're doing this for Barnsley or wherever.
Absolutely. And in the survey that we've been doing, people were reporting that they actually identified a little bit more with people locally. They cared for people locally and they wanted to help local people more than they would want to help people nationally.
Now, Greg Feld, you've been listening to what Gillie's been saying. What lessons do you derive from what Gillie's been saying practically for you?
Yeah, a few brief thoughts. One of my significant concerns is youngish people who have this illness, and we know there are a significant number of them, but will have really mild symptoms. The reality is most of us will have mild symptoms. Half of us will have symptoms and not even notice. We won't get a test, because if we get a test, well, someone's going to tell us that we need to self-isolate for 14 days.
I'll tough it out, I'll be fine, which most young people will be fine. But if they go and then interact with their gran, she may not be fine. So getting some of that messaging out there is really, really important. It's one of the things that most directors of public health worry a lot about, actually. And the other one is the people not observing isolation when they're told they've got a positive test. We know 50% of people don't do that. If we're talking about opportunities to reduce transmission, those are the two biggest things by a mile. Julie picked up a point about the guidelines, and they're a bit complicated. Yeah, they are. They're really complicated. So if I'm in Leicester, I can't go and buy a pair of socks. Well, I probably could if I went to Loughborough, but am I allowed to go to Loughborough? I don't know, and there's some tricky stuff there. But can I go and visit my neighbour? Can I go and visit my gran? And getting into the complexity, and I know a resident of Leicester who is scratching his head. It's unsurprising that people get confused, because the messaging needs to be crystal clear.
Well, OK, let's presume for a moment I'm the Secretary of State for Health, and I'm consulting with the directors of public health in various cities and areas, and I'm asking you what I should do to try and get the message to be more consistent.
Simplify. We're at peak guidance. I've lost track of the number of pieces of guidance that are out there, and I'm supposed to read it all. Members of the public are never going to be able to keep up with that. In all of that guidance, there are some fairly basic principles about viral transmission, infection prevention and control, distance, hand washing, staying at home if you've got symptoms, getting tested early. Those kinds of things permeate through all of the guidance. Let's not talk about the 1 metre versus 2 metre versus 1 metre plus rule. Regardless of the nuances, regardless of the setting, cut through it all with really simple, crystal clear messages. Easier said than done. I know it's easier said than done. We tried to do it and it's not easy.
Well, there's a crystal clear message gone out from the Treasury this week. Go and have a drink at the pub. Is that going to help you?
Bluntly, no. My message to folk in my town is that don't be under the impression we've beaten this virus, that it's gone away. It hasn't. This has got a long, long, long time to run yet.
I also think, having gone slightly confusingly into the Leicester lockdown, government would dispute that, but I think the messaging was not as sort of clear and clearly signalled as it could have been. It's really important to learn from that experience and set a framework. It won't stop people, as Greg was describing, applying their judgment in local circumstances, and it shouldn't sort of overly circumscribe what public authorities can do, but to set a framework, given we almost certainly will have more of these local lockdowns, is going to be a feature of our lives for the next 6, 9, 12 months or longer. It would help us all to know what framework we're operating in.
Alex Thomas there with Gilly Gibson-Miller and Greg Fell. And my conclusion, well, I have two conclusions, really. First, there's a lot of confusion out there. Second, Leicester is either an experiment or a prototype. If the infection rates go down there reasonably quickly, expect to see similar local lockdowns coming to an outbreak, possibly near you. My thanks to Amy Orton, Natalie McDermott, Damian McGuinness, Alex Thomas, Greg Fell and Dr. Gilly Gibson-Miller. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Joe Kent and Beth Sagar-Fenton. The editor was Jasper Corbett and the studio manager was Neva Misirian. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including ones on the search for a corona vaccine, on how to ease lockdown safely, or for something completely different, on the link between meat and climate change. You can find them all and much more on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Theresa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.